Okay, welcome everybody for coming back. I apologize for a break last week. I was in the air, literally, and wasn't able to make it, even virtually, to teach. But I'd like to pick up from where we left off last week. Now, first of all, sort of mentioning the fact that I was flying in the air, the best way to do what we're going to try to do today would be to go on, well, the best way would be to take a plane and to travel to modern-day Iraq and to go and see the sites in Babylonia that we're going to discuss. Because today, our topic is really starting from the ground up, right? The theories is about the Talmud and its world, and when we think of the most physical manifestation of the world, we think of the earth, the ground, the places in Babylonia. So ideally, if we had the funds and the politics were different, we would all take a plane and travel to Babylonia. Barring that, the next best thing that we could do would be to use a program like Google Earth to take a virtual tour. And I encourage all of you, when you get a chance to try to do this, the best way to do it is to download Google Earth and use their search function to find Babylonia and to work from there to truly get the lay of the land. You can zoom in, you can see the different rivers that we're going to discuss, and get a sense of the territory. What we're going to do instead, we will have a map, as you'll see in a few minutes. We're going to learn textual sources to help us enter into that world of Babylonia, to help us look, scan, survey the scene, see what the rivers are, the towns, and the villages, and use that. A map obviously is an artificial tool, but use that, the map and the texts, which are maps, as we'll soon see, to really begin to understand what the world of the Talmud really was. Now, before I begin, I just want to mention, if there are any questions, please leave them for the end. I prefer if you type them in, but if you don't want to type, you could also speak them. But at the same time, I did want to allow a few questions, if there are any left over from already 2 weeks ago. I don't know if anyone remembers their questions from then, but I apologize for not really leaving a lot of time for questions. So if there are a couple of questions, you're welcome to ask them in the next couple of minutes, next couple of seconds, but if not, we're going to get going and look at the various sources. So I'm looking at our attendees. I don't see any hands raised. So I'm going to take it as a sign that we can learn the sources that we're going to learn today. Wonderful. Okay, now I'm going to switch the, and I hope tech can help me out here. I'm going to momentarily switch the screen to a map, a picture of a map. It's now on my screen coming up, and I hope that you can all see it. Can you see it? Can the attendees sort of raise their hand if they can see the map instead of the text? Yes, okay. So I assume if Michael can see it, then everyone can see it. Ideally, you would enlarge this map, but we're going to use this map again as a tool to understand the lay of the land. Now, first of all, this is actually two maps. It's a bit confusing. So on one side of the map, let me get at my pointer. Okay, here we have a pointer. This is a larger area of Babylonia, where my pointer is right now. And on this side of the map, we have a close-up of the area that we're going to be discussing in detail. So, if we had a larger map, and we're going to use a map in our brains, things would look like this. Let's start from the land of Israel, from Eretz Yisrael. Of course, Israel is on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And If you, in your mind's eye, go or fly eastward from the land of Israel, the first country you're going to hit is Jordan. If you continue going east on a straight line, you don't veer south to Saudi Arabia, but keep it going straight, you then hit Iraq. And the area that we're interested in, Jewish Babylonia, as we're going to call it, is in more or less in central eastern Iraq. The main features of Babylonia, now I'm going to use my pointer, are two rivers. We have two rivers here. One river is coming down like that and spilling into the Persian Gulf. It actually begins even further up. I should have pointed with the pointer. And another river, goes like this and comes very, very close to the other river. I'll tell you the names of the rivers in a second. And also ends up spilling into the Persian Gulf. Now, another name for this area, is Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is a Greek way of saying between the rivers. And this area, Babylonia, was referred to by ancients as Bein HaNaharot, the area between the rivers. That changed everything drastically. Because technically, the areas surrounding Babylonia, Mesopotamia, were very, very arid. Few things could grow there, even with the best help of irrigation. And only through the rivers, these two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, was Babylonia in this area able to thrive. To thrive from really, really early antiquity to old Babylonian times and even before that, up until the Talmudic era that we're interested in, which again is from the 3rd to the 7th centuries of the Common Era. So these rivers, the Tigris, which is on the right side here, and the Euphrates, which is on the left, are essential rivers, not just for commerce, and not just for the main imaginative features of their land, what people think about, but for the very ability of these rivers to give life to the area, to make the area green and fertile through irrigation, of course. But these two rivers made Babylonia or Mesopotamia happen. And when you go home, you're already home, but when you use your computers later and use Google Earth, you'll be able to see how the areas right around the rivers to this day are full of farmland and agriculture. And if you just, let's say, travel a couple of kilometers past the areas right next to the rivers, it's gray, it's brown, it's arid, because few things can grow there without the help of very sophisticated irrigation. So that is what we need when we talk about Jewish Babylonia. And now I'm going to use my pointer again, and you'll see, right, you'll see there's a gray area. There's a gray area that begins right here, and at the bottom is colored all through the central area, and then at the top again, is closed, and again, that's the part of the map that is blown up on the left side. That is Jewish Babylonia. Now, let me back up again when I use the word Babylonia. There's an ancient city, which we're going to come to in a few minutes, called Babylon. Babylon was a specific area, founded by Nebuchadnezzar, or became important with Nebuchadnezzar, but in time, by certain groups, especially the Jews, the entire area came to be referred to Babylonia. And that creates a certain slippage and complication. So sometimes you see sources that seem to be talking about a place called Babel, Babylonia, and might be read as the city or might be read as the region, and that's something that we have to keep in mind as we go through some of these sources. So let's start learning the sources. I'm now going to switch the screen back to the source sheet. And let's do that right now. Here we go. Should be loading up. Great. Okay, the source sheet is loaded up. What's most interesting to me is not simply the physical geography of this place, which we kind of saw via the map. Yes, it's in between two rivers. It's very fertile. This was a center of commerce, really a center of the world, politically, commercially, culturally. But what I'm especially interested in is Babylonia as it was imagined by the Jews, and Babylonia as it was imagined by the rabbis of the Talmud. Now, when I use the word imagined, I don't mean to say that it's something that's not real, kind of a derogatory term. Sometimes, in our day and age, when we talk about imagination, we mean to downgrade it, to say, oh, it's not real, it's something that children do. But imagination, the way I'm going to be using it, is the way in people's minds that certain realities are constructed, certain ways of looking at things. So regardless of what the physical features of a place are, and the physical features that more or less everyone could agree on, this is a relatively green area, this is a relatively moist area, there's lots of water flowing here, everyone can agree on that. An imagined reality will be certain things that people can see because they're wearing special glasses, that they have a tradition, a way of looking at a place based on something collective, something shared, and that is the imagined Babylonia that I'm going to be interested in now. Not just the physical place, but also the way the physical place interfaces with an imagined place. And the best, and really the place to begin to do that, if we want to understand what was Jewish Babylonia, what was this place, is to think about how Jews thought about places in relation to families, in relation to lineage. It sounds sort of like a strange combination. I mean, a place is, you know, you can map it. It's a physical thing. It's two-dimensional, three-dimensional, depending on how you want to look at it, how you want to map it. And there's a discrete set of boundaries. Well, a family is a set of relationships. It's a way people are related to each other. Interestingly enough, from very early on, there's an attempt, specifically regarding Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael, to think about these places by means of lineage, by means of where people descend from, right? Where people, who people are related to. So when we think about the areas of Eretz Yisrael, and to this day some of these areas are still used, we think about the Shvatim, the tribes. Right, there are different areas. Yehuda and Binyamin are the areas that include and abut Jerusalem. So they're kind of the most well-known. So Judah and Benjamin, those tribes come to be associated with certain parts of Eretz Israel when they are allocated to those tribes. And forevermore, to this day, that association remains. That there are different tribes that are associated with different places. So somehow families and tribes and lineage creep in and are kind of provide lenses for ways of thinking about places. But something even more interesting happened regarding that relationship between places and families. And that really doesn't take off until the first return to Eretz Yisrael. After the exile, after the destruction of the first temple, of the first Beit HaMikdash. So the Jews finally are given permission to return to the land of Israel. And in two very important svarim for understanding the history of this time, Ezra and Nehemiah, which actually might be considered one sefer, there's a list of different places in the vicinity, in the region of Babylonia, and different families from those places that ascend. And that go up to the land of Israel. Now, most of the lists there are just numbers. This many people came from this area, this family, and this many people came from that. But sometimes we have kind of judgment calls, because a very, very important issue for Ezra and especially Nehemiah was the lineage of the people who were coming in and recreating anew. The community in Eretz Yisrael, right? Ezra and Nehemiah are are leaders of the Jewish people, elected by the Persian officials, or have some kind of formal relationship with the Persian officials, and one of their greatest concerns is to make sure that proper lineage is maintained. And I'm going to explain what that means in a second. It's not merely yichus in the Yiddish sense, it's something much more profound. Now, something that gets Nehemiah into some trouble is by A, railing against intermarriage, because it seems that some of the people who returned and some of the people who were already living in Eretz Yisrael who had never left were intermarried with non-Israelites, non-Jews, and that created problems when he railed against intermarriage, if you look at the Sefer, because obviously not everyone was happy with that. And also, you have a general problem that the two leaders have with the inhabitants of the land of Israel, with the Amei Haaretz, right? The term that becomes very popular in rabbinic literature, Am Haaretz, and now is in our lexicon as well, so to speak. The people who don't know anything, the riffraff, however you want to term it. That term, Am Haaretz, is a very important word in these Svarim, because it relates to the fact that people who remained in Eretz Yisrael, many of them, most of them for that matter, were not exactly the cream of the crop. And were not people who were keeping Torah and Mitzvot the way that they should have been kept. There was intermarriage, there were all kinds of problems. So when Ezra and Nehemiah bring back these Jewish people from Babylonia, there's a clash, there's a problem in the way the people living in the land of Israel aren't really living up to the ideals of the land of Israel, and sort of Ezra and Nehemiah have to do damage control. As part of that damage control, you have discussions of lineage, right? Because, as we know in Judaism, there is, first of all, a sense that one is not allowed to marry outside of the, we can call it the faith, right? Media Raisa, this is the emphasis of this, is on the seven Canaanite nations, the seven nations that were in Eretz Yisrael before we even came up from Mitzrayim. And that is kind of the overarching prohibition. And associated with that as well is the prohibition in general of intermarrying outside of the religion, outside of the group. But beyond that, there are other problematic marriages that might occur. So for example, there's a term also, unfortunately well known, a term called mamzer. The technical, meaning of mamzer is according to most opinions, a child born out of wedlock. Rather, it's a child born from a specific illicit, union, who is then no longer able to marry into the kind of the regular, the normative community of Israel. You have other groups as well, as we're going to see in a Mishnah, in Kiddushin. And part of what is going on as these Jews are coming back to the land of Israel is an attempt to weed out and separate out these different groups to make sure that everyone is sort of marrying within their group, and is not marrying within a group that they're prohibited from marrying. So if we just take one pasuk from Nehemiah, right, and this is in that long list of different people from different places that are coming up to the land of Israel, let's look at source one of the handout. So it says, Ve'ele ha'olim mitel melach tel charsha kruv adon v'imer. And these are the people who come from all of these different places. V'lo yachlu lahagid beit avotam v'zaram im Yisrael he. So you have a list of places. And unlike the other preceding sukkim, which describe numbers and places and where people are coming from, this list is, this specific group of towns is a problem. Because they don't even know what their problem is. In other words, they don't know that they are the category of Nitin, as we'll see in a moment, or Mamzer. They don't know what they are. So the way the pasuk expresses it is velo yachlu lahagid beit avotam. They were unable to pronounce, to proclaim their father's houses, kind of their lineage, whether im Yisraelim, whether they even came from Yisrael, whether they even came from the Jewish people. And that problem, kind of the relationship between a group of people coming up from a place, and these family problems, these lineage problems, is already there in Sefer Nehemiah and that pasuk. And in fact, the Mishnah Kiddushin tells us, as I just explained, that this is exactly what was going on in Sefer, in Ezra and Nehemiah. So if you look at source 2 now, really this is the first Mishnah in the fourth and last parak of Masechet Kiddushin. This Mishnah appears in the Talmud Bavli on Daf Ayin Amud Aleph. And I'm going to read this source because it's very, at least part of it, because it's a very important source for getting a sense of what's going on. So, Asara Yuchasin Alumi Bavel. There are 10 different lineage groups, we'll call them, that go up from Babylonia. Kohane, Levi, Yisrael, Chalale, Geire, V'chamuri, Manzeri, Netine, Shetuki, Vasu. There are 10 different groups. I won't define all of them because some of them are debated in the Gemara. But you have the three first groups, which we know. Priests, Kohanim, Levites, Leviim, Yisrael, people who are kind of the general Israelites who don't have the special privileges of working in the Beit HaMikdash, receiving truma, that sort of thing. And then you have, so those are sort of the unproblematic groups. They're allowed to marry, as we'll see in a second, amongst the, you know, themselves. A Yisrael is allowed to marry a Kohen can marry a Levi, etc. And then you have the beginning of the problematic group. So you have something called the Halal, who came from priestly stock, but something problematic happened along the way. In other words, their father was a priest, a Kohen, but their mother was someone who a Kohen, a priest, is not allowed to marry, and therefore the child is a Halal and cannot marry a Kohen. Geirim are converts, and converts are not supposed to marry priests, even though they are allowed to marry Levi and Israel. And the list continues with groups that not only are barred from marrying the priesthood, but actually can't marry even a regular Yisrael. So, for example, the Manzerim, people who were born from an illicit union, or descend from those born from an illicit union, need to marry within their group. So you have a list of these 10 different categories that are delineated here, but they're set in a specific historical context. It's a very interesting Mishnah. It doesn't just say these are the different groups for lineage, but it ties these groups into the Aliyah from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, the going up from Babylonia to the land of Israel. Now, if we just continue the source a bit more, and we'll see what we said, Kohanim, Levim, Yisrael, Mutarim, Levo, Zebeteh, priests, Levites, and Israelites can marry one another. Levi, Yisrael, Chalali, Geri, V'chaluri, Mutarim, Levo, Zebeteh, a Levi, a Yisrael, a Halal, a Ger, and a Haruri, which we won't describe right now, they are allowed to marry one another. So in other words, really all the Mishnah seems to be interested in is the halachic discussion here, the halachic import of these different groups, right? In other words, it's almost funny that the Mishnah was tied to this historical moment, right? Usually the Mishnah, not usually, the Mishnah is not a history book. The Mishnah is a law book. The Mishnah is interested in Jewish law. So it's kind of funny that the way these laws are set down is again tied into historical narrative. Right? If we wanted to write the Mishnah as follows, Asara Yuchsin Alami Bavel. I'm sorry, take that out. We could just say, Asara Yuchsin Heim. There are 10 different kinds of lineages. There are priests, Levites, etc. And then talk about the laws. The fact that it's tied into a specific historical moment is very interesting. We can leave it at that. Now, before we continue with the Gemara, any like questions that are directly related to this source, you can, I guess, raise your hand and let me know. Okay, it looks like there are no questions that directly related to what we're doing. Okay, so let's continue now with the Gemara. There are a few interesting things that happened. The first question is, and now we're continuing in the next same source number, but in the next paragraph, right, where it says Gimel Mem, which stands for Gemara. So the Gemara, as we learned last week, and most of us already know, is first and foremost interested in explaining Mishnah, explaining the words, the structure, the way it works. And here, there's a very basic question. Asara yuchasin alu mibatel. There are ten different lineages that came up from Babylonia. So the question is, my iria detani alu mibatel. Right? Why is the emphasis here that they went up from Babylonia? Nitni halchu l'Eretz Yisrael. Why does it not say that they went to the land of Israel? The Gemara is bothered and troubled by kind of a strange word, a strange verb. If you want to say that someone goes somewhere, if you would want to talk about immigration, and think about what a word would be, what kind of verb would be used for immigrate, for humans moving from one place to another. So the root would be halach, hey, lamed, chaf. But for some reason, the Mishnah uses the word ayin lamed, al, to go up. What's going on here? Why is that word being used? So the Gemara explains, milta agav orche kamash malach. That the Gemara is just trying to teach us something along the way. Kidetanya, as we learn in the Braita, it says regarding going up to the Beit Hamikdash for the fruits. It says "Vakamta valita lamakom asher yifkar Hashem Elokecha," that you should get up and go to the place that God, the Lord your God, will choose. So this teaches us three things, really. Two things. This teaches us that the Beit HaMikdash is higher than the rest of the land of Israel. And also, the Eretz Yisrael Gvoha Mikol Ha'aretzot. And Eretz Yisrael is higher than all other lands. So in other words, the word halach, to go, if the Mishnah simply read, Asara Yuchsin Halchu Lebavel, that wouldn't do justice to what it means to go to the land of Israel. Because one doesn't simply go to the land of Israel. One goes up to the land of Israel, as we learn in that source. That the Beit HaMikdash and really Eretz Yisrael in general, apparently because there are two verbs used there, in that source, it says, Vikamta Vialita. That there are two gradations. First, there's the gradation of all the other lands in the world, and then there's the gradation of Eretz Yisrael, and then there's the Beit HaMikdash. Now, actually, other sources in the Gemara tell us that this is kind of an oversimplification, this source kind of is enough. I see that Helen, that Haina Ryder has a problem with her sound. Does anyone else have a problem with their sound? I just want to make sure I'm not... Okay. Everyone's okay. Wonderful. So that's the first thing the Gemara does with this Mishnah. The Gemara comments and seems to be making just a linguistic point, but actually I think there's something much more profound going on here. The Gemara is trying to say that there's a hierarchy here. There's a kind of hierarchy here. Because one doesn't just go from Babylonia to Israel, one goes up from Babylonia to Israel. That means that, in a way, right, the land of Israel is higher than Babylonia. Now, I don't think that the way to read this Gemara is simply about topography. That Eretz Yisrael is higher than all the lands, other lands in the world. Now, it certainly is higher than Babylonia. If we think back to our map, and you look at it at Google Earth, Babylonia is low marshland. It's very low. And Eretz Yisrael is relatively high, right? But even if you don't take into account the Himalayas, if you just look, if you live in Yerushalayim and you look at Har HaBayit, you can see that physically the topography of Har HaBayit is higher than most of the city, but there are areas that are higher than it. So Mount Scopus seems to be higher than Har HaBayit. So when the Medrash and the Gemara talks about the land of Israel being higher than all other lands, and Har HaBayit, or the Beit HaMikdash, the Temple Mount, being higher than all other places in the world, it's not meant to be in physical topography, but kind of a combination between physical topography, because one does feel the ascent. You can still feel it when you drive on Kish Echad, going up into Jerusalem. But also a spiritual topography, kind of this joining together of the physical reality of going up to Jerusalem and to the Temple Mount, and also of the spiritual ascent as well. So that means that there is a kind of hierarchy here and a recognition that as great as Babylonia is, as we'll see in a bit, Eretz Yisrael is higher. But now let's look at the next source, right? With that kind of setup, the next part of the Gemara, we're actually still in the same source, has this to say. It's a very similar sort of question. So now we're in the third paragraph in source 2. My area, the Taniyelu Mibavel. Why does it say that they go up from Babylonia? Nitnu Alul Eretz Yisrael. Why is there an emphasis on the place that they left? Right? It says that these 10 groups, these lineage groups, left Babylonia essentially and went up to the land of Israel. Why emphasize where they came from? Isn't the important part of the journey where you're going to? Right? Nitznu Alul Eretz Yisrael. Why doesn't it say they went up to the land of Israel? And that Eretz Yisrael works with the verb alu, to go up. So here we have the next piece, which actually becomes an important aspect of this Gemara. Misayeya Leila Rebbe Elazar. This idea, or this linguistic kind of code in the Mishnah, that they're not going up to Israel, but they're going up from Babylonia, is support something that Rabbi Elazar said. Damar Rabbi Elazar, lo ala Ezra mibavel, ad sha'asa'a kisolet mikiyaz ala. That Ezra did not leave Babylonia until he made it like clean flour. And then he went up. The Gemara and really stretches for a few pages to explain exactly what this means and how it works. But the basic idea, according to the Bavli's understanding, is that Ezra took out a lot of the riffraff when he went up to Eretz Yisrael. It's almost like an anticlimactic vision. Here, finally, the beginnings, the stirrings of the Geula, of the redemption, are here. The Jews have been in exile. They've been suffering in exile, and finally, they're given permission to ascend and go to the land of Israel. As we know, this took some time. Right? First, Koresh announced the possibility, but it didn't exactly happen right away, and there was some political problem. But finally, the word is given, and they begin to ascend to the land of Israel. Yet, the Gemara is telling us that we know that the people who ended up going, not all of them, but a good deal of the people who ended up going, were riffraff, were people whose lineage was suspect, who might have descended from some of those problematic groups that we saw in the Mishnah, who might have descended from Geiri, who might have descended from Mamzeri, who might have descended from Netini, these different groups, and they weren't simply Israelites from, you know, pure lineage going all the way back up to Abraham. So, therefore, the Mishnah uses the word alumi bavel, that they went up from Babylonia, to emphasize the way that their going up from Babylonia left Babylonia in a pure state. Now, in fact, we don't have time to do the rest of the Gemara here, but there's a question as to how this happened. Were the riffraff forced to leave Babylonia? Were they just willing to leave because they didn't have that much invested in Babylonia? It's an interesting question. But the fact that this Gemara this passage kind of works in an opposite direction of the passage that came before it, right? As much as Eretz Yisrael is set up as this land that is higher, we're now introduced to this idea that that the riffraff end up in Eretz Yisrael and leave Babylonia a very clean place indeed. And that idea works through the rest of the Gemara. Right? This parak, this chapter in Kiddushin is interested in the way these lineages work, or at least the beginning part of the chapter. And it's based on this principle that Eretz Yisrael is kind of, there's a hierarchy. I didn't put this on the source, but I should have. There's a hierarchy of places. And in the lineage hierarchy, it works as follows. Babylonia is at the top rung. Babylonia contains the best lineage. If you marry a Jew in a certain area, you can pretty much assume that they are not of some kind of problematic genealogical history, and one will have nothing to worry about. Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is one rung underneath Babylonia. And then, right, other lands are below Eretz Yisrael. So in a way, it's a reverse hierarchy from what we saw. Instead of Eretz Yisrael being at the very top, Eretz Yisrael is demoted under Babylonia. Now, this rivalry between Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael was one of the greatest rivalries and geographical rivalries in Jewish history. Right, its beginnings are even before this Gemara, before the time of the Gemara. But as the time of the Gemara continues, after the closing of the Yerushalmi, when there's apparent silence from the land of Eretz Yisrael, though it's not exactly silence, there begins to be this kind of feeling, at least from the Babylonian perspective, that Babel is superior to Eretz Yisrael. That Babel is, as we'll soon see, in a way has superseded Eretz Yisrael, has become a new Eretz Yisrael. With the acknowledgement, of course, that Eretz Yisrael itself, the physical geography of the land of Israel, remains profound and important and great. So therefore, when one goes to Israel, one ascends. But for all other intents and purposes, Babylonia achieves the status, at least in the eyes of Babylonia. And this rivalry is actually interesting because usually, you know, as we described the last time that we met, Babylonia, most of our sources and what Jews are used to looking at when we study things is the Bavli, right, is the Babylonian Talmud. When you look at the Yerushalmi, for example, in an extended sugya like this, or one in Maseches Ketubot that we're going to see in a bit, you get a very different picture. That when the sources are emanating from Eretz Yisrael, it's not exactly clear that Babylonia is sort of this end-all and be-all and the best place. And that would be expected. So the rivalry is not a one-sided rivalry. But the Eretz Yisraelites, the Israelis, so to speak, kind of hit back at the Babylonians. There's even a very funny, there's a very funny source that we're not going to get to look at, but that makes fun of this superior complex of the Babylonians and says, isn't there a verse that says, Ki mi Bavel teitei Torah? Or these are the Israelis talking. Right? Isn't there a verse that says that the Torah comes out of Babylonia? Obviously, that's not what the verse says. It's one of the best known verses in the book of Yeshayahu. Ki mi Tzion teitei Torah? Right? Because from Tzion, Zion, Israel, the Torah, or Jerusalem, the Torah goes down. But the Israelis kind of pun on the use, or on the superior complex of the Babylonians. And we're gonna get into that in 1 minute. But before we do that, I want to, and we might not get to do that until next time, I see by looking at the time. I want to then see how this kind of way of thinking about Eretz Yisrael informs how Babylonia was imagined. Right, how Jews looked at Babylonia. How do we know what the boundaries of Babylonia are? Right, we started the class with that map of Babylonia with the gray shading that indicated what was Jewish Babylonia. What, you mean to tell me there were no Jews living outside of that gray area? That there weren't Jews further east, further north, further south towards the Persian Gulf? Of course there were Jews there. That gray shading comes from a sugya actually in Masechet Kiddushin, just a few pages away from the source number two, that really maps Babylonia. Now, I want to look at that source, but as we're looking at it, I want to think about what it means really to map Babylonia. Now, the purpose of this source is, again, for lineage. That's the point of the chapter. And the halakhic import is, where can one marry and not worry that they're marrying someone who might come from the stock of a mamzer, and therefore it's a prohibited marriage. So the halakhic import is clear. If you stay within the confines of this area, you're marrying someone who is sort of kosher for you to marry. But if you think about what it means to map a place from a halakhic perspective, and what other place in Jewish tradition we map, then it's striking, because of course it's Eretz Yisrael that we map. It's Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, that we think about, especially in terms of its boundaries. So we have already in Sefer Bereishit, when God speaks to Avram Avinu and he describes what he's going to give Avram Avinu, he doesn't just simply say the land of Israel, but he maps it. And actually, at the brief end of the Tarim, when he tells Avram Avinu what he's going to give him, he tells him a very vast territory, and there are specific landmarks. And then when you go to Sefer Shemot and look at Parak Lamed Gimel, I believe it is, you see very specific boundaries, slightly different than at the Brit Bein HaBetzarim, that delineate where Eretz Yisrael is. And in Bamidbar as well, there are further delineations of the boundaries. And of course, when the land is actually allocated in Sefer Yehoshua, the details are incredible in terms of how detailed a map Yehoshua creates in understanding what the territory is, who gets what territory, etc. So the act of mapping Eretz Yisrael is not just for the halakhic issues, which are many, and it's not just for the inheritance legal issues, I believe, but it's almost like a ritual sacred act. When you map a territory, and when you cord it off, and it's a territory that you understand as a people is given to you by God, it's a very sacred task. And it's a very sacred act to map a holy place. It's not just a practicality, cartography, which is something that, I think the politicians that are helping us come to some agreement with the Palestinians need to understand that if these people see, and, we could say the Palestinians as well, see this territory, and the mapping of the territory is kind of a sacred act, and not just, expediency, then it creates a whole new charged level of what's going on, right? Eretz Yisrael, for us, when we map it, that is a sacred act. So it's amazing when you think about the sugya that we're about to glance at that really goes into detail and maps the land of Babylonia. Yes, the purpose is for lineage, but the mapping of Babylonia is, in a way, an attempt to say that Babylonia isn't just like other lands. It's not just like Parthia. It's not just like Rome, for that matter. But Babylonia has this special status, has this almost Eretz Yisraeli status, at least according to the Babylonians. So if you look at source number three, Amar Rav Papa Saba Mishmei Dera. Rav Papa Saba says the name of Rav. There's some issues with the manuscripts as to who exactly is talking. It might be Rava, it might be Rav, but we have an important statement that's stemming from an important Amora. And it goes like this. Bavel Bria. Babylonia is healthy. Meshan or Meshin is Mita. The area of Meshin is dead. Or Metai, really should be read. And Madai is Chola. Media, the area of Media, is sick, is ill, and Elam Goseset. Elam is, I won't translate what Goseset is right now, but is very ill. Okay, we can call it that. So here you have another, and there are a few of these in the Sugya. There you have another list of different kinds of territory. Babylonia, out of all of these kind of adjacent areas, is healthy. And healthy in terms of lineage. Messene is dead. Meaning, when you meet a potential spouse there, you're basically meeting someone that you're not supposed to marry from a halachic perspective. Media is ill, and Elam is very ill. So the Gemara asks, Ma bein cholim gosim? What's the difference between those who are ill and those who are gosim? Rov cholim lechayim, most people who are ill will actually recover, and rov gosim lemita, most people who are gosim, that word, are going to die. So in other words, Elam is even worse off than Babylonia. Than Mada. Now, the Gemara then uses this as an opportunity to map Babylonia. Ad hechan hi bata. Until where is Babylonia? Rav amar ad nahar azak, ushmol amar ad nahar yonai, le'el bedid blat ad hechan. So first they map one part of the territory. We don't have time to go back to our map, but you'll go back to when you have time. From Nahar Azak, according to Rav, according to Shmuel, it's from Nahar Yonai, going up the Euphrates, which again is the river on the left, Ad Hecha. So Rav Amar Ad Bagda, Va'avna, Ushmuel Amar Ad Moshchani, V'lo Moshchani B'chol. So we don't have time to really dissect exactly where these places are. But you have a disagreement as to where the boundaries of Babylonia for that legal issue, what is considered healthy, this area, and there is a dispute as to what's in the territory and what's outside. If you're outside of the territory, then you have a problem, right? You're not going to be able to marry into the community inside the territory. And that is a legal boundary. But as you can see, and we don't have time for the rest of the sugya, but as the source goes down and down and down and continues, and I didn't even give you all of it, it's very clear that this isn't just about lineage, but it's about a way of understanding what is the almost semi-holy space of Babylonia, this special place of Babylonia. So getting back to what we started with, that means when you look at Babylonia from Chazal's eyes, from the Babu's eyes, you're not just looking at a place between two great rivers that grows things and has a great economy, but you're looking at a discrete territory in which is deemed healthy in terms of lineage, and as other sources confirm, is deemed healthy in terms of Torah observance, in terms of people who are kind of committed to halacha and to Chazal's view of life. Now there are some people, or many people, who aren't exactly doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing all the time, even within that boundary. But for the most part, you're dealing with a healthy area from Chazal's perspective, and that's another part of what's being mapped there as well. Any questions at this point? I see we only have like 10 minutes left. But I'll take a couple of questions before we continue, if there are any. Okay. Here's a question. What happens to people who are from the areas, meaning the other areas? Well, we don't know exactly, because we don't have much, we really don't have any historical evidence besides the Gemara as to what was going on in the whole diaspora. So, I'm sorry, I should repeat the question. I don't know if everyone can say. The question is, what happened to the people with a questionable lineage, who are descended from these different kinds of groups, these problematic groups? So we don't exactly know, because the Gemara is mostly interested in what's going on in Babylonia itself, in Jewish Babylonia itself, and we don't have really much textual evidence. We are going to talk about in a few weeks the evidence, physical evidence that seems to come from non-rabbinic groups, Jewish groups, such as these magic incantation bowls and certain kinds of them that seem to be very non-rabbinic. It could be that those reflect the communities outside the boundaries, but it's a very complicated issue that we'll get to. Yeah, you can use your mic. Yes, that's a very good point. It's not a positive thing that there's a riffraff here, but it is a reality, and that rivalry is clear, and maybe that would be something that the community in Eretz Yisrael would respond. So one more question. I think Bert has a question. I'm going to take Bert's question for the time being just because he asked if he can use his mic. And I'll get to Stanley. Bert, you have a question? Okay, I can hear Bert's question. So I'm going to pass Bert, I'm sorry, and maybe you'll be able to write it later. Stanley just has the quick question about what percentage of the population of Jewish Babylonia were actually Jewish. We don't really know, because we don't have any real demographic statistics, but we do know, based on some reports of Arabic historians, that there were lots of Jews. And what's most interesting is that as much as there were lots of Jews, the Iranians were in charge in Babylonia, and they were the rulers, it seems that the majority of the population were made up of people that we could call Arameans, that is, people who spoke Aramaic and not Persian. So we don't know that the Jews had a majority, but we're pretty certain that people who spoke Aramaic had a majority. And these people would include Jews, certain communities of Christians, and also Mandeans, another group that we're going to talk about. So we don't know exactly what the population is. No, do not look at Jewish Babylonia as Borough Park. Okay.
I can talk now if that's just been enabled. If you, I don't want to talk over anybody else simultaneously. My question now. This is Bert.
Okay, quick question. I'm sorry, but yeah, quick question is great.
Yeah, the question that I have is, it just seems to me this is a tremendous amount of self-promotion on the part of the Babylonians. After all, what kind of good Jews are they that don't aspire to make Aliyah? All the riffraff went to Israel, and the good people were there. How good could they be if they're all staying in Babylonia?
That's a very good question. Okay. If you've been coming up, I'm hearing an echo. Okay, great. Very good question about this is kind of an inferior complex. The fact that the Babylonians didn't go up to the land of Israel means that is a reason for saying that the people in Israel aren't worth it and are riffraff. We're going to talk about some of these issues in the next few classes, and I wanted to get to them today. But it's a bit more complicated than simply an inferiority complex, because we do know that the moment the community in Babylonia bursts onto the scene of Jewish history, and that really, again, is through primarily through the Gemara, it seems very rabbinic and very committed to rabbinic ideas. So we have a source here or there in Josephus that talks about not such rabbinic activity going on in Jewish Babylonia, but from the moment that we kind of get a picture as to what's going on, it does seem to be a very rabbinic community. On the other hand, when you do look at the vast variety of evidence in Eretz Yisrael, and there were obviously important Amorayim and Tanayim living in Eretz Yisrael, it's a much messier place. And you can see this when you tour around Eretz Yisrael, right? Even during this time. There are all kinds of synagogues with funny pictures of the Zodiac, and maybe even worse than them, than just the Zodiac. It doesn't seem like a very rabbinic place. And that might be just because we have more evidence that's remained in Eretz Yisrael. But we're going to get to that question on a deeper level. But you're right. One would think that it's kind of a, it's a response that the Babylonians to say that the riffraff went to Eretz Yisrael. And the sugya that I guess we're going to have to do next week really deals with that. The sugya in Ketubot, which is essentially a pro-Aliyah sugya. We'll just take 1 minute here. If you look at the last source, actually no, it's not on this page. There's a sugya around Kuf Yud Aleph, Amud Bet, in Ketubot, that is concerned with the laws of Aliyah. What happens if a husband wants to make Aliyah and a wife doesn't? What happens if the wife wants to make Aliyah and the husband doesn't? And the sugya is interested in sources about kind of pro-Aliyah sources, but at the same time, it has to respond in a way that, you know, Bert referred to. It has to basically say that as much as Eretz Yisrael is this great value, and we saw that hierarchy even at the beginning of our Gemara, there are other reasons why Babylonia is better. And often those reasons seem to center on Torah and the role of Torah and rabbinic Judaism. We're going to have to stop there. I actually wanted to accomplish much more. But we're going to pick up with specific areas in Babylonia next week. We'll talk about Mechoza, Kumpadita, Sura, Naharda, and then we're going to, talk about some Jewish history in Babylonia. So if people want to have my email, I'll leave you my email. It's shy, I'll type it right now, shy.secunda@gmail.com. And actually, we'll try to get to Stanley's question next week also. I'll try to address it in the class because it might be worth thinking about Babylonia, parts of it as Manhattan more than Brooklyn. And that's not just because I've lived in Manhattan before, but there might be a real comparison there. So I think we're going to call it here. Any quick questions that anyone has? Okay, so we're gonna close it here, and we'll see you next Sunday. Thanks so much for joining, and I hope you all have a wonderful day.